as I was leaving my house this morning, going out to daven, so my wife turned to me, crestfallen, and she said, "You know, I promised Simcha pancakes, and I see I have no eggs, so I think he'll be out of luck." So I told her, I said, "You know, I said, I'm saying an entire share about this today. So that's not so simple." So she was a little perplexed by that. So what we're going to talk about today is the halachic obligation to honor your word. Now, we're not talking about whether it's a kinyan or a binding contract. That, of course, that's all a chash mishpat is about, binding contracts and binding obligations. We're going to talk about the more general question of the need to keep your promises, keep your commitments, to honor your word, even in the absence of any formal contract, the absence of any kinyan, the absence of anything. The mere fact that that someone promises something creates an obligation that he has to live up to his promise. We're going to discuss the parameters of that, when that applies, how that applies. And as it turns out, the particular case study of my little boy, who is almost two, will illustrate a number of the issues we'll be discussing rather nicely. It's a good fact pattern to discuss some of the issues that will come up. Now, this discussion begins with a pasuk in this week's parasha, Parshas Kedoshim. It actually is not the pshat in the pasuk. It's actually a somewhat far-fetched drash. Nevertheless, it's one of those ironic things. The drash that Chazal make from this pasuk is, I think, much better known. It has much more application, and it comes up much, much more often in the rabbinic literature and halacha lemaisa, probably than the original actual intent of pshat in the pasuk. The Torah says, "Lo sasu avol b'mishpat." You shall not commit a perversion in justice. The Torah says that more than once in this parasha. A couple of pages earlier, we already had Lo sasu avol b'mishpat. Torah is very concerned about injustice. In this particular case, the pasuk goes on to elaborate b'mida, b'mishkal, b'mesura, different types of weights and measures and volume and weight and so on. The pasuk goes on, moznei tzedek, avnei tzedek, efas tzedek. A person has to have scales, honest scales, just scales. Avnei tzedek, the stones, the weights used to weigh have to be honest. Efas tzedek, v'hin tzedek. Different types of measures of volume, the efa and the hin, also have to be tzedek. Yielachem, get the ani Hashem alokechem, asher tesi eschem eretz Mitzrayim. You get the general idea. A person has to be honest in all his dealings. And this is actually a specific law in the Torah. It's counted by the chinuch, let's say. It's counted by the monei mitzvahs. Besides all the other things you can't do, stealing, lo sigza, lo signa, there's a particular law against having dishonest weights and measures. There is, however, a drasha of Chazal, which, again, is not Pashup Shana on the Pasuk, but the drasha of Chazal is a kind of pun, a play on words. The word hin, hey yud nun, in biblical Hebrew, is a volume measure. However, Chazal understand it in the word hein, meaning the word yes. Gemara b'Metzia, the first item on the handouts here. This is called the sugya of mechusar amana. Mechusar amana means absence of faith, lack of faith. In English, we would translate that roughly as faithlessness, a person who doesn't keep his word. So the Gemara begins with a story. It says that Rav Kahana had received some cash, a partial payment for Kisna, for some flax. Then the price moved, the price of flax went up, the buyer hadn't taken delivery yet. Rav Kahana wanted to renege on the deal because the original terms were no longer to his advantage. He can get a better price by selling the flax at the current market price. So he went to Rav, the Amora Rav, and Rav told him, basically you're right, whatever cash they gave you is kona that much of the flax, but the rest of it, you are not bound, you can release yourself from the obligation and renegotiate the terms with this or a different buyer. So the Gemara goes on to explain, this is actually a machlokas between Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, and the way the Gemara describes the dispute, the Gemara calls this mechusrei amana, being faithless. Is there a halachic objection? Is there moral opprobrium to reneging on your word like this? So Rav, l'shitase, Rav says no. Rav says a person is not obligated to keep his word. Yes, he made a commitment to the buyer to give it to him at this price, but as long as there was no kinyan, in this case, we're not going to get into the technical details of kinyan, in this case, there was no binding kinyan on the bulk of the flax, and therefore he could renege on the remainder of the deal. When the cash he was paid, he has to give that much flax. That was a kinyan. The rest of it is not a kinyan. Rabbi Yochanan agrees there was no kinyan on the rest of the flax. Rabbi Yochanan says, you still can't renege, though. Dvarim yesh bahem mishum mechusar amana. Rabbi Yochanan says, even mere words, you have the moral stricture of mechusar amana, chusar amana. The Torah does not allow you to be faithless. Now again, he doesn't use the word asur. He doesn't say you're not allowed. He uses an interesting locution, yesh bahem mishum mechusri amana. By breaking your word, you fall into the category of this rabbinic, or we'll discuss whether it's rabbinic or biblical, this halachic disapproval for what you are doing. The halacha follows Rabbi Yochanan, halacha and Shulchan Aruch, and all the poskim follows Rabbi Yochanan. Even a mere verbal promise, informal, nothing in writing, no kinyan, nothing has been executed, nothing has been formalized. The halacha follows Rabbi Yochanan that in general, dvarim yesh bahem mechus ramana, a person, the halacha expects a person to live up to his commitments. That's a good question. That's an excellent point. This Gemara actually occurs in the layout of the Talmudic text directly after, as a kind of development of the Sugya Mishapara. We'll discuss in a moment the relationship of this to Mishapara, but it is something similar. It is definitely congruent. As a matter of fact, one of the major tshuvas on our subject, which is long and complicated, I didn't excerpt it here, but one of the major tshuvas of the Maharam Mintz, or Moshe Mintz, in the 15th century, he repeatedly tries to infer some of the guidelines and parameters of Mechus Ramana from the idea of Mishapara, which maybe we'll return to in a moment.
It's also like
Yes, so that's also a good point. Midvar Sheker Terchak is the general exhortation to be honest. So this is kind of a special case of honesty, of keeping your word in the sense of a promise. Midvar Sheker Terchak can refer to a statement about the past, can refer to all kinds of statements that can be true or false without being in the sense of a commitment that you're breaking. This is kind of a special case. You might also be of Midrash Sheker Terchak, perhaps not. That's really a topic for a separate discussion. What are the parameters of Midrash Sheker Terchak? Some say that only applies in the judicial context. Many say it doesn't, but you're right. In many cases, you also may be violating Midrash Sheker Terchak. On the other hand, we should point out, and we'll see the continuation of the sugya in a moment. In general, if I promise to do something and then don't keep my word, it's arguable whether that's Midvar Sheker Terchak. At least if the promise was made in good faith, I didn't say a falsehood. I said I will do this. I plan to do it. I changed my mind. Now I'm not doing it. We can debate philologically, philosophically. Is that a lie? I mean, I promised to do it, and I changed my mind. Now I'm not doing it. Certainly, if it's not a promise, if I just say I'm going to go to the store, then I say, oh, I changed my mind. I didn't promise anyone anything. I just changed my mind. I don't think you've said I've lied. I've changed my mind. So the question is, a commitment that you're not allowed to change your mind, then that falls more easily under the category that we're discussing today of Chosir Amana and less under the category of Midvash Sheker Terchak. But let's just see the continuation of the Gemara. The Gemara goes on. The Gemara brings our Pasuk. Matal Medlomer Hin Sedek Hin is Bechlal Eifa. Eifa is about six times a Hin, I think. Rashi goes through the arithmetic for you. So they're both different forms of measures. Why does the Torah have to keep belaboring the point, telling you, and the Torah says measure in the general term too. Amida, Mesura, Mishkal, we already know all the rules. Why does the Torah have to add the explicit references to Hin and Eifa? Elomar lecha, she'eh Hin shel chat tzedek, v'lav shel chat tzedek. Your yes has to be tzedek, your no has to be tzedek. Rashi explains, when you say Hin or lav, kayim dvarech, you have to fulfill your words, v'hatzdek osam, act in such a way that your words turn out to be righteous, meaning keep your word. Now, sorry? That's going to be a crucial question. We'll get to that soon. That's one of the key questions here. Abaya says, what is Rav going to do? Rav says a person is under no halachic injunction to keep his word. Rav says, this is different. This is shleidaber echad bepev echad belev. The pasuk of Hin Tzedek, according to the Drash of Chazal, does not refer to keeping your word. It refers to not promising one thing when you have no intention to keep it. In English, we would say promising in bad faith. So the Gemara pretty clearly discusses two types of keeping your word. The kind that everyone agrees is unacceptable is promising in bad faith, promising to do something that you have no intention of keeping. That's certainly a problem. The other kind, promising in good faith, honestly meaning to do it and then changing your mind, that's machlokes Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, and we paskin, like Rabbi Yochanan, that even that is usher. Now, there is considerable question in the poskim whether this is a iser daraisa or not. So we do bring a pasuk. On the other hand, it's not Pashup Shana the pasuk. And also we should note that the Gemara seems to say, at least according to Rav, the Gemara suggests that the pasuk actually refers to promising in bad faith. We find several opinions in the poskim. Some poskim say all of this is an asmachta, all of this is not a real drasha, the issues here are rabbinic, and none of this is actually a mitzvah daraisa. We do find opinions that say this is daraisa. For example, the Minchas Chinuch, if you look in number 5 here, Minchas Chinuch says, this is a mitzvah saseh, it's daraisa, and he actually says, kofen, we'll return to that a little bit later, but he takes for granted. Now again, the Minchas Chinuch is going on the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch primarily discusses honest weights and measures. In the course of the discussion, the Chinuch mentions, the Minchas Chinuch mentions, it also includes, according to Chazal, being honest, but the Minchas Chinuch takes for granted that that also is a deraisa sense, even though it's a drasha, it's not pashup shat. Nevertheless, Chazal told us that's included, so the halacha follows the view that this is deraisa. Some say it's only an asmachta. The Minchas Chinuch himself goes on and says that according to the Rambam, it might be an asmachta. The Netziv argues, based on one girsa in a manuscript of the She'iltas Rav Achai, a Gaonic manuscript that also we held to as Drabban, Amru Rabbanan, the Girsa was, or the rabbi said, don't do this. Some say it's Daraisa, some say it's Drabbanan, and some distinguish between promising in bad faith and promising in good faith and reneging. Promising in bad faith, they want to argue that's egregious, that's Daraisa. Promising in good faith and changing your mind, that's only rabbinic, that's only Mechus Ramana, that's not as bad. We basically have three opinions. It could be everything's daraisa, it could be nothing's daraisa, it could be promising in bad faith is daraisa, and changing your mind, reneging on a promise, is drabbanan. So that's the first basic step. We have this thing that it's halacha disapproves, maybe daraisa, may not be daraisa, but it is a halacha psuka. The Shulchan Aruch and all the poskim agree that even if you promised in good faith and you change your mind, that is a serious problem. Now you mentioned Mishapara. Mishapara is a very similar halacha that refers to a case where people are working on a sale. The buyer has given money, full or even partial payment, for the goods or maybe even services that he's contracting for. And then one party wants to renege. It can be either the buyer or the seller. So the halacha is, in many cases, with personal property as opposed to real estate, kesef, we paskin, is not a kenyan. At least, it's not a Kenyan, that the rabbis gave you the right to renege on a deal as long as you haven't executed a proper Kenyan, taken possession, or other Kenyanim that we do. However, the Mishnah tells us that there is a curse, an anathema we pronounce against the person who reneges. We say, Mishapara. Mishapara is shorthand. Mishapara means he who has exacted retribution, meaning he who has punished the Dar HaMabul, the Dar HaPlaga, some of the great biblical punishments on record, he, meaning God, will punish the person who reneges on his word and doesn't go through in a sale in which money has already changed hands. There's actually a discussion in the Talmud whether the curse is just recorded in the Talmud, and we inform you that Chazal had this view toward you. Others actually say we actually pronounce this curse. Basin actually gets up and pronounces the curse with an intent, with an eye toward this person who's reneging. That is a very similar din. Basin doesn't force you necessarily. We'll discuss forcing soon. But the simple idea would be, the simple way of reading the Gemara is Basin does not force you to abide by the terms, since there was no Kenyan, but Basin will make it very clear that you are acting improperly. Mechus Ramana is a very similar thing. The basic difference in when they apply is the halacha is clear. Mishapara only applies if cash has actually changed hands. That not only have they made concrete commitments, they actually transferred money. Now the money might not be a Kenyan, but money was recognized by Chazal as enough of a reason to kick in this din of Mishapara. Our discussion tonight of Mechus Ramana is broader, is even if no money has changed hands. The implication clearly is Mishapara is worse. If you've gone so far as money changing hands, you're certainly gonna have Mechus Ramana, but you'll also have Mishapara. In many cases we're dealing with, most cases, when no money actually changed hands, you're left with Mechus Ramana, which is a similar thing. The Chazal clearly look disapprovingly at what you're doing, but it's probably not enforceable. That's something actually we'll have to discuss soon, whether if this is in any way enforceable by Beis Din or not.
Can Mechus Ramana lead to a loss of
Kashrut? That's an excellent question. That we'll discuss too. So let's turn to all these questions now. What exactly are the consequences of Mechus Ramana? What happens to a person who is Mechus Ramana? A God-fearing person shouldn't be Mechus Ramana, but what happens to someone who does? What are the social and halachic consequences of someone who does? So this is what I said before, that there are poskim who, the Maramints, who derive halachas, who compare Mechus Ramana Mishapara. Maramints, quoting even earlier sources, basically says that the person is an Avarian, the person is a Rasha. It is permitted to call him a Rasha. it is permitted and appropriate to engage in public shaming. We should announce that so-and-so, Basin, may not be prepared to enforce that he keep his word, but we are going to announce what he's doing and publicize that he's a Russia as a form of moral suasion, as a form of pressuring him to keep his word. One of the main sources of the Maramintz was a 15th century authority, German authority. One of his main sources is the Maram of Rattenberg, who was a 13th century authority. If you look in number four here, the case in the Maramintz actually concerned a bris milah, honoring someone with bris milah, to perform the mitzvah of bris. Now, most of the cases of Mechus Ramana we're discussing, the original Talmudic context is business, is buying and selling. Most of the literature in Shulchan Aruch and elsewhere, Shulchan Aruch codifies it in the context of buying and selling, the laws of Mechakul Memkar. Most of the halacha concerns buying and selling. But as we'll see, there are generalizations by the poskim. The Shlach, for example, the Shlach says it includes any commitment to do a favor for somebody, any commitment to do something good for somebody. And here again, back to the pancakes. They weren't doing business, but a promise to provide somebody with food, certainly according to the Shlach, and that's, I think, I don't know if there's any dispute about this, would probably qualify as a promise, a commitment to do something to someone else's benefit, which would fall under the rubric of Mechus Ramana if you don't keep it. So the Maram of Rattenberg was asked about a case of somebody honored, promised a moel he'd get to do the milah, then he wanted to change his mind, there were scheduling issues, they weren't sure he would make it, it was a complicated case, but the underlying case was a father promised the privilege, the honor of bris milah to a certain person, wanted to know about changing his mind and giving it to somebody else. In general, you give a kibbutz to somebody, you promise to keep it to somebody, then you want to withdraw it and give it to somebody else. It happens. So the Maram says that a similar case occurred a century or two earlier in the time of Rabbeinu Tam, that also a man had a son, he promised the milah to a certain moel, someone else came along. So the Maram has different aspects to his analysis, but the part that interests us right now is if before the milah has been snatched by somebody else, if both contenders are still here, then the Maram says, Rabbeinu Tam said, Vadai, the appropriate thing is to give it to the person to whom it was initially promised. What if you don't? The Hadarbe, so Pirish Rivam, he brings from another one of the Balei Tosfos, the Rivam, She'ain Basin Nichol Ma'akvo. The question was, is it enforceable that Basin, Maram says clearly, no, it is not. Basin cannot force you to honor your word, to keep your word. Aval, he says, who over Mishum She'eris Yisrael Yasu Avlov Lo Yidabru Chazav. Now, for some reason, instead of bringing the pasuk of Hin Tzedek, and it's not clear why he does this, Hin Tzedek is a verse in the Pentateuch, and he brings instead a pasuk elsewhere in the Chaf Dalad, Tzvani, I think, She'eris Yisrael Yasu Avlov Lo Yidabru Chazav. This pasuk is widely quoted by the poskim on Arsig, as well as poskim elsewhere in Halacha, as a declaration. It's a statement, it's a normative statement, a descriptive statement about Jews. Jews are honest. It's certainly aspirational. Hopefully we live up to it most of the time. But Jews are supposed to be honest. Lo yasu avla, they do not perpetrate iniquities. Lo yidabru chazav, they don't speak falsely. So a person who doesn't keep his word violates this signature quality of Jews, that they're honest, umutr likrosa Russia. So Maram seems to say, b'shem the Rivam, Basin cannot compel compliance. They will, however, tell you that you are in violation of a biblical norm, and they will actually call you a Russia, and the Maramin certainly understands, call you a Russia doesn't mean they'll whisper it in your ear. It means they will publicize, they will publicly shame you and announce, so-and-so is an Avarian, is a Russia for not keeping his word. Yes? Yes, that's a good point. The poskim do use the word nadar. I believe it is lav dafka. In many cases where a promise would have the status of a nadar, for example, if the promise was to hektish or to anim, then it's much more significant. It's very easy for a simple promise to be a nadar. You don't have to use the word swear. In many cases, a promise to do a mitzvah has the status of a nadar. And so if it actually is a nadar, we're dealing with things that are much more serious than Mechus Ramana. So I believe that the language of nadar here is lav dafka, that it probably just, nadar is just being used colloquially to mean, like we say, I promised to give you a ride, I promised to give you pancakes. We don't mean it was a promise, mitzad hel cheshvua, they have to make a taras and darim for. We just mean, like colloquially, it was a promise. I think that's all it means, although I have to read all the tshuvas more carefully.
So two points. One is, in this Hasan Dharma, I remember when we were doing it, there are certain circumstances circumstances where we don't even, the nether that's used is understood to mean not in a serious way. Like if there are two people arguing over or bargaining over a price, and I say, I make a nether, I won't have any on off, this is the
right.
Worst.
You're referring.
Those nidre don't even need to be.
You're talking about the Gemara of Nidre, Ansim, Nidre, Shkagos, Nidre, Zruzin, Nidre.
It's language and they don't mean it, right? And I think that could that apply in other business circumstances? I promise you I'll do it. I mean, but people know this doesn't happen.
It could. You know, it is true that one of the key fundamental rules of Nedarim is that context plays a role. You know, we don't just look at the words in a vacuum. We do look at the context. It is true, yes, that certain times we would say it's clear from context they don't mean a neder. Nevertheless, the rules are very, very strict, and it's very easy for the poskim to look at something as an actual neder. Yeah. You say something else?
The other point is that you asked about the difference in Pesukim. So the thing with the Avnei Tzedek and the Hin, it's a business context. And the other situation here is like a promise for who's going to do the
right. So that's a good point.
In Kiddushin, where they also taught, they use the same pasuk where a guy promises his wife that they'll marry from her side as opposed to promising from his side. They also use this pasuk about Sheres Yisroel Yasa.
Okay. So you're suggesting
non-monetary. They use this pasuk in
right.
a monetary sense.
So. Interesting point. There is a chida in Birkei Yosef who also plays with this question of whether the idea of Hin Tzedek is limited to business. He has an inference from a Rambam. Other things. So there is a possibility to say that. But nevertheless, I think the general trend of the poskim, they kind of use them interchangeably. They discuss Mechus Ramana, they discuss Sheres Yisrael, business, not business. You're right, we could possibly construct a model. I'd have to give that further thought and go through the Maror Makomos. But for the line I'll be taking tonight, we'll be using the two roughly interchangeably, that Mechus Ramana, Hin Tzedek, Sheres Yisrael, Yasu Avla, these are all the strictures against breaking your word. But you're right, there is possibility of making two dinim out of it, of making two separate approaches. Now, the Maram explicitly says, basin cannot be kofeh. It's actually not that simple at all. In the Maramint, which I did not excerpt, it's a long, complicated, and difficult tshuva to get through. The Maramint, he brings this Maram. Later on in the tshuva, he directly addresses the question of, are we kofeh, are we not kofeh? And he says, in principle, we should be kofa, because, and he makes a very important point to understand when studying Choshen Mishpat, which is, Choshen Mishpat basically parallels civil law, modern civil law. These are the rules of adjudicating between two litigants. There's a plaintiff, there's a defendant. The court is essentially a neutral arbiter between applying the law to resolve disputes between two parties. Now, as we've discussed in the past, as Professor Rockover says, a unique or a special aspect of Choshen Mishpat, of halacha, is that halacha extends far beyond the civil. And even in certainly we have kashrus, we have basar b'chalav, which are also in Shulchan Aruch, we have Shabbos. But even in Choshen Mishpat, even in the laws that regulate between relations between individuals, the halacha also extends far beyond what is enforceable in Beis Din. So Rockover was discussing the idea of midas tom, of lefi mishuras hadin. He contrasts secular law, where we say the law is the law. If it's legal, then it's legal. Everything else is in my private business, and it's not a legal question anymore. It's not the court's business. We have professional ethics. We have corporate ethics. We have academic ethics. These are not legal things generally. These are completely separate processes, which are in other venues. Halacha is not like that. Halacha has beyond the shuras hadin. We have, like we said, lefim shuras hadin. We have midas tom. And one of the things we often have is the idea of a chiyuv lasat zedei shamayim, and we have chiyuvim which are not necessarily enforceable by Beis Din, but are still mitzvahs. Now, the Maramintz points out, the halacha is that, this perhaps sounds may sound jarring to our 21st century ears, but the halacha anticipates a theocracy. Halacha anticipates the authorities, the government, as having the power to, as we've discussed before, to compel compliance with all of Torah, not just the civil, Hilchos Shabbos, Hilchos Kashrus. If we were powerful enough and somebody wanted to eat a ham sandwich, we would say, no, you may not. The same way, to a small extent, Israel shuts down certain things on Shabbos, and for a while you couldn't sell chametz or pork or whatever it is. There are some rules. Halacha anticipates, based in enforcing people in general, to enforcing the halacha in general, compelling people to comply with the halacha. So any mitzvah, we do this. So the question then becomes, even if we don't look at a simple naked promise as a civilly enforceable commitment, but it's a mitzvah, and you're an avarian, and you're a rasha if you don't do it. So why shouldn't Beis Din step in and apply, not acting as a civil arbiter, why shouldn't they simply step in, kofen ala mitzvahs? The Gemara in Ksuvahs, you mentioned this in number 2, the Gemara in Ksuvahs says that if a person says, I don't want to do a mitzvah, what happens? So we tell him, a person doesn't want to build a sukkah, doesn't want to take a lulav, we tell him, makinos tachdeitz nafsho. We beat him until he gives in. There's no, you know, the modern, you know, modern religious, you know, liberal thinkers talk about how everything has to be choice and compulsion is worthless. Halacha doesn't take that view. Traditional halacha was that, yes, you know, voluntary compliance is ideal, but we are going to go the involuntary route if voluntary compliance doesn't get us there. And as a matter of fact, this Gemara illustrates the point I'm making, the bridge between civil and religious obligations. The Gemara itself articulates a doctrine called Priyas Balchov Mitzvah. The Gemara says there is a mitzvah to repay debts. Now, there's also a concept called shibud, shibud adaraisa, shibud adarabanan. Shibud is a civil notion, that the creditor has a civil claim against the debtor. But even if you say shibud alav daraisa, even if you say that on a biblical level the Torah does not create a civilly enforceable claim against a debtor, the Gemara explains, midaraisa, there is a mitzvah the debtor has to pay back his debts. Actually, and there's a lot of struggling by the commentators to explain what the mitzvah is. If you think about it, there is no explicit biblical verse that tells a debtor, pay back your debts. It says, don't steal. It tells an employer in this week's parasha, Lo Sashok, pay a worker, don't cheat your workers out of their wages. Wage theft, they call it. Bal Tolin, pay workers on time, and so on. So there's a lot of discussion about different types of cheating, but actually telling a debtor to pay on time is not explicitly commanded anywhere in the Bible. So or at least not in the Chmishchem Sheitara. So the Mefarshim actually struggled to figure out what is the source of the mitzvah the Gemara says pay back debts. Some say it falls under the golden rule, v'haftal recha kamocha, love thy neighbor as thyself. Some say it's a kind of a fortiori kal v'chomer from Ashur HaSaveda, which is a problem. You know, all these approaches have some degree of problem associated with them. Ashur HaSaveda, as we've discussed in the past, is only an obligation if it comes at no cost to you. You don't have to spend money to return an aveda. Debts, you know, work differently. So there's all kinds of struggling to explain what the mitzvah to pay back a debt is. But Rashi, which I've included here in number two, Rashi says, Rashi says the mitzvah itself is the mitzvah of hin tzedek, of keeping your word. The same way even a promise to buy or a promise to sell or a promise to give a gift, promise to give pancakes, all these types of promises are create mitzvahs to do and averas to violate. So a promise to pay back a debt is also a mitzvah. And on this mitzvah, the Gemara says, Kofinosa, makinos tachitetze nafsho. So the Maramint raises this question. He says, why am I telling you that Basin is not going to be kofa somebody to keep his word, but it's a mitzvah, and mitzvahs you have to keep, and Basin forces you to do mitzvahs if you don't do it. So even if it doesn't create a civil claim by the creditor, by the recipient of the promise, but why shouldn't Basin force you to keep your word? So the Maramint kind of gives a pragmatic answer. He says that Basin doesn't have so much power, and Chazal tell us that just as there's a mitzvah to say things that people will listen to, sometimes discretion is the better part of valor. Basin shouldn't overextend itself and start trying to be too aggressive and too intrusive. And of course, Bavon Sein Harabim in today's generation where people have no Yirah Shemayim and people have chutzpah and so on. He basically says that for just being realistic, being practical, as a concession to the fallen spiritual level of the generation, Basin does not actually try to compel. Now, again, I'm not sure what the Matzias was. Basin apparently was able to compel compliance with Shulchan Aruch when it was mandatory. They weren't so far gone that they would ignore Shulchan Aruch entirely. But if Basin tried to compel compliance with an informal promise, then people would rebel and be parikol and give Basin a hard time. I guess you have to be there to understand the dynamic. I'll call upon the Maramint's conclusion is that in principle, in the time of Chazal, there would have been basis for Basin to use compulsion to force somebody to live up to his promise. Today we don't do that, he says, even though in theory we should. Today we don't, but we do tell him this much we do. Public shaming we do. Again, that apparently doesn't result in this type of precus all he's worried about. Calling somebody an avarian in public and so on, that we do. Making sure he understands that he's a Russia, that everyone understands that he's behaving improperly, that we do. But we don't actually do kofin. Now, there are some authorities who say we do kofin. So, for example, going back to Menchas Chinuch I mentioned before, in number 5, the Menchas Chinuch says it's a mitzvah. He says it's daraisa. He acknowledges it's machlokas, but he says at least the pashtus is, he begins by assuming it's daraisa. If it's daraisa, he says kofin oso kmo kol mitzvah saseh. Drabanan, maybe not, he says, but if it's daraisa, we will be kofin. Others disagree. Michas Pitim, Remeir Arik, great posik from about a century ago, Polish posik from about a century ago. He strongly disagrees. He says he doesn't know what the Menachas Chinuch is talking about. It's clear from the Shulchan Aruch, from all the sources, that it's a simple premise, a promise of that even if you violate Mechus Ramana, it's not actionable by Basin. Basin does not force you to do it. Kimavur b'Shulchan Aruch. And the answer, I think, for the Menachas Chinuch is kind of what I was alluding to before. The poskim sometimes are a little bit vague about the difference between invoking compulsion as a civil matter and invoking it as a ritual matter of kofen ala mitzvahs. Sometimes poskim say that when it says Beis Din has no authority to enforce it, they mean as civilly they have no right to compel, but in their capacity and wearing their other hat, in their capacity as enforcers of public morality, they do have the right to be kofen. The end result is the same. You'll get hit on the head until you give in. So you can argue whether the Shulchan Aruch is mashma, they can't compel at all, they only can't compel in their capacity as civil arbiters, but they can in their capacity as enforcers of public morality. But in any event, the Minchas Chinuch seriously says, maybe you could be kofa. The Maramin seems to say, in principle you could, in practice we don't. Rameir Arik says, takes for granted that Lamaisa, we are not kofa.
So those shitas that are saying that you can be kofa, what is the function of the kinyan? In other words, if you're going to sell me something and I say I want to buy it, then according to those shitas, it's enforceable at that point.
So that's a good question. So one difference, and that's going to be what we're going to talk about now, is that Mechus Ramana has certain restrictions. There are going to be certain cases where Mechus Ramana does not apply, where a Kenyan certainly would. So Kenyan certainly will have that advantage. If beyond that, you know, putting aside those maybe corner cases or cases where Kenyan would be binding, Mechus Ramana would not, that is an interesting question. Why do we always stress the idea of Kenyan? Mishapara, Chazal also clearly imply Mishapara won't be enforceable. It's just that you use moral suasion. That's a good question, right? I don't fully understand that. That's a point I'd have to think about more carefully. Definitely a crucial question. Why do Chazal always imply that? I guess that's what Rameir Arik means. That it's clear from the poskim that without Kenyan, Mechus Ramana is not enforceable. Those who say it is, we'd have to explain better than why in all the cases where Chazal say no Kenyan is not binding. Have to discuss why that would be. Yes. So, turning now to the question of some of these exceptions or limitations on Mechus Ramana, and this will help us understand the situation of the pancakes better. So there are a number of limitations poskim discuss, debate on when Mechus Ramana applies. One of them, proposed by the Hafla, who wasn't actually so sure about it, in the 18th century, the Hafla said, he proposed in the context of explaining a Gemara and Ksuvas, but the Hafla proposed Mechus Ramana only applies if the promise was made directly to the recipient. If it was made to someone else, like if you tell your wife, I'm going to give our nephew $100 birthday present, and then you change your mind, since the promise wasn't made directly to the recipient, some poskim following the Hafla say that there is no binding rule of Mechus Ramana. The Minchas Pitim, Rameir Arik again, goes back and forth on this question. One of the sources he brings from the Kehilas Yaakov, not the Stifler, but I think Al-Ghazi, Svar de Kehilas Yaakov. He brings that the Kehilas Yaakov says that if someone promises a minor, a katan, then Mechus Ramana applies. So Rameir Arik says a katan should have the status of Shelo B'fanav, because he doesn't have the maturity of an adult, he assumes. I don't really understand why, but he assumes that for our purposes, there are certain other contexts in Chazal in which a katan is Shelo B'fanav. So for example, there's a rule that you don't accept witnesses outside the presence of the litigant. If I'm bringing testimony against you, you have to be there. Kind of what we call in criminal cases, we call it the right to confront your accuser. The halacha has a similar rule in civil cases that you have the right to be present if we're bringing witnesses who are going to testify against your interest. A katan, it says, is always considered not there because he doesn't have the sophistication, the maturity, the capacity to fight and challenge the witnesses. So that I understand. Here, it's just a question of the promise. The way the Hafla explains it, the way the Hafla explains why Shelo B'fanav doesn't have Mechus Ramana, he really goes back to the Gemara. He points out a facet of the Gemara which I haven't covered yet, which I should have, which is that I don't think I have it in the excerpt here. The Gemara goes on to distinguish between Matana Meruba and Matana Muetis, a commitment to give a large gift versus a commitment to give a small gift. Commitment to give a small gift falls under the rule of Mechus Ramana. You're not allowed to renege. Commitment to give a large gift does not. Large and small are not defined. The Gemara explains the reason is that what it hinges on is whether the recipient is so mechdas, a favorite expression of Chazal, whether the recipient is Somech Das, whether he relies on it, whether he accepts it, whether he's convinced that you're really going to do it. If it's a large promise, he thinks, you know, words are wind, you know, he doesn't know that you're really going to do it. If it's a small amount, then he's pretty confident you are going to do it, then Mechus Ramana kicks in. So there is an opinion, therefore, I think, in the Betzel HaChachma, or Betzel Stern, he says that the standard by which you calculate large or small, he doesn't give you exact numbers, but the guideline, he says, is in relation to the resources of the promiser. That because the recipient has to decide whether he thinks the promiser is really serious and committed or not, the level of commitment he assumes on the part of the promiser has to do with the promiser's resources. If a guy who makes $20 million a year says, I'll give you a present of $1,000, for him, you know, it's nothing, so if he says it, he means it. A guy who makes $50,000 a year and promises you $1,000, it's a big deal. So you're not convinced he means it. So that's the doctrine of Smichus Das. Mechus Ramana only applies when we assume that the recipient is Somech Das. The Haflah, therefore, says that if a promise wasn't made directly to the recipient, even if he somehow hears about it, is not going to be Somech Das. So Rameir Arik assumes that for a katan, the same thing applies. I don't know why. A katan certainly is capable of relying on a promise. Certainly an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old. Now we can argue in the case of my little boy who's less than 2, whether he really has the notion of promise. He certainly knows when you tell him something, I guess he expects to get it. Even a 2-year-old, I can argue, is capable of understanding that, you know, and I actually am pretty, I try to be pretty particular about this. A kid should learn that your word is your word. If you promise something, you do it. Even if you threaten, you should do it. You know, that person should learn that people do what they say. So I would think even a 2-year-old, certainly an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old, is capable of understanding a promise. So I don't know why Rameir Arik thinks it's so simple to compare a minor to a shlomo fana, but that's what he says.
I would think it would work the other way, because a child, because of their naivete, would be more likely to believe.
He hasn't experienced so much betrayal and so much. Yeah, right. That's true.
It's almost like you favor the child.
Because you cause him to get lose faith, and you can argue that too. People, there's another reason katan is worse. People point out a katan can't be mochel. So the post can take for granted pretty much that mechus ramana you can be mochel. If the person you made the promise to releases you from it, that's fine. It's not better than a kinyan. He can release you from a kinyan, he can release you from a promise. But a katan can't release you. So for all these reasons, for chinuch, for lifnei iver, for his naivete, you know, so one could definitely argue that it should apply to a minor. So I would be reluctant, and again, the Rameir Arik brings a sefer, Kilas Yaakov, who says explicitly that there is Mechus Ramana. So the fact that the promise of pancakes was made to a boy who is 23 months old, I don't think would be a reason to release my wife from having to honor it. Now, there is another question, and there is another question we should discuss. That is probably the most central question of Mechus Ramana. Most cases that I have seen that have come to us in Beis Din, that have come to us, you know, informally, most cases that I've heard about Mechus Ramana tend to devolve around one specific point, and that is the notion of what we call, term of art, we call Trei Tari. Trei Tari is Aramaic. It is the Aramaic version of Shnei Sha'arim, literally two prices. This is a machlokes rishonim. I didn't quote the actual sources. They're technical and involved. But there is a machlokes rishonim whether the rule of Mechus Ramana applies even if circumstances have changed. The specific circumstance discussed by the rishonim is the price has moved. So, for example, like in the original case of the Gemara, where he agreed to sell flax, and then the price moved before delivery. But post can extend it to other types of circumstances where things have changed, facts have changed. By the time you get around to honoring your commitment, the circumstances no longer make it as attractive to you as they to the person who promised as they originally were. Is there still a din of Mechus Ramana in such a case? Now, I mean, here is a classic idea of an example of where kinyan would be very different. You made a kinyan, you're pretty much stuck. Certainly, if you made a kinyan, you'd actually transfer title. Even if you made an actual contract, there's some discussion, but very likely you couldn't back out of a real kinyan. Mechus Ramana, however, is a major machlokes rishonim, whether you're still bound to keep your word even if prices or other circumstances have changed. And going down from the Rishonim, the early Rishonim, all the way down to contemporary Poskim, there are two schools of thought. There is no consensus on this question. The Rama in Shulchan Aruch brings both opinions and says the Iker is like the stringent view, that a person should not break his word even if circumstances have changed. The Chasam Sofer seems to imply that the Iker, he thinks the Iker is like the lenient view, the Shlah, who's anyway a kind of very pious and very immorally serious work, takes a stringent view that you really should be Machmer. Post can go back and forth, and even among contemporary Dayanim, as far as I know, you'll get different views as to how strict a person has to be in a case of Trey Tari, of where the circumstances have changed. And as I've said, most cases seem to boil down to this. Usually a person's number one excuse, even just intuitively, for breaking his word is because things have changed. And that's why I want to break my word. So again, the basin has to figure out whether things have changed significantly enough. And again, how far they have to change is also not clear. So posts can go both ways. There are some posts who say that the whole debate about the price changing or circumstances changing is only if they change in a relatively minor way, but a major change. Everyone would agree that you're allowed to back out. I cite that in an opinion of the Mlo HaRoim in number 10. He says that the whole debate is only about Chesaron Porta when the prices move slightly, but if it moves drastically, if there's a significant reason, his case was an employer agreed to hire employees to do a certain job, to, let's say, do agricultural work, and then it rained, so you don't need the watering of the field, or you can't perform the hoeing, or whatever it is, the field is not suitable. He says, of course there's no mechusar amana there. You're not breaking your word. What am I supposed to do, he says. What choice do I have? I should pay you for not doing the work? And that doesn't make any sense, he says. And that's a major, there'll be a major expense for me to pay you, he says. So there, everyone agrees there's no need to keep your word, that there's no moral stricture in keeping your word. But you know, I don't know if everyone agrees to that. I think there are some posts who would say that even a significant price change, you're still expected to live up to your commitment. In my case of the pancakes this morning, it's a little different. Nothing changed, just my wife promised pancakes on the assumption that she had all the ingredients. It turned out that she did not. So this actually comes up again, halacha l'maaseh, very often. What about cases where it's not that something changed or that a new opportunity developed, you became aware of an opportunity or became aware of something that you weren't aware of before? It happens all the time in real estate. You make a commitment to rent a property for $2,000, then you find an even better location at the same price, or you find a same type of property for cheaper. People always want to know, I didn't sign anything, or that, but I made a commitment. Do I have to? This is literally Maisim B'chol Yom. People have these types of questions. It's a very serious question. As we've said, it could be a daraisa according to some poskim, even if there's nothing in writing, no kinyan, nothing beyond a commitment. Now again, poskim do say the commitment has to be solid. If you just said, okay, it looks like we're going forward, or you know, I imagine we'll be doing it, that might not be a commitment. Commitment is, I plan to rent this property. No qualifications, no anything. If you have a solid commitment, then you want to back out. You're dealing with potentially a daraisa. You're dealing with something which you could be called a rasha for. One of the main heterim, as we've said, is often Trey Tari, and contemporary posts can discuss how do we apply Trey Tari to cases where the other opportunity was there all along, but you didn't notice it. Some posts can say it depends whether you should have noticed it. If the option was there, you just didn't bother looking for it, then you're committed. You agreed that you're not willing to look, that you're not going to bother to look, and you're committed to whatever you agreed to. Other posts can say, no, it's true I didn't look, but I wasn't aware of that opportunity. Now that I found out there's another opportunity, that's like Trey Tari. As we mentioned, Trey Tari itself, not everyone agrees to. There are Ma and other posts can say a person should machmer even on Trey Tari. So when a person comes to me and asks me, you know, as I said, this is a very common shaila. A person comes to me and asks me, I made a promise. I found a better alternative. It developed later. It didn't develop later. But let's say I wasn't able to find out about it at the time. It was an obscure thing that there's no reasonable way I would have found out about it. Now someone brought it to my attention. These are very serious questions. It's there is no clear resolution in the halacha. There are poskim who go both ways on this, and these are serious questions. There's another issue which I'll just cover briefly. Mechusar amana is kind of little brother to a real kinyan. You didn't make a real kinyan, but you made a verbal commitment, so we expect you to keep your word. What happens in cases where even a real kinyan wouldn't work? For example, davar shlo b'la'olam. I tell you that I plan to buy this property within the next week or two. I should close. I'm selling it to you today. That's called davar shlo b'la'olam, davar sheino b'reshuso. You cannot transact business with regard to property that you don't currently own. So the question arises in the poskim: what happens? Will I still be bound on mechusar amana? If I told you I expect to close in a week or two, I'm committed to selling this property to you. Will I be bound at least by mechusar amana to do it? Some poskim say yes. Who cares about kinyan? Mechusar amana doesn't need a kinyan. Even a simple verbal promise commits you and puts you under the stricture of mechusar amana. Other poskim say no. Other poskim say mechusar amana only works in a case where a real kinyan would work, where real kinyan wouldn't work, even if Chutz Marana doesn't apply. One of the main sources of the discussion goes back to the Mila case, as you pointed out. That's not something where kinyan might not be shayach over there. We're dealing with a promise to honor somebody with a bris mila, kinyan dvarim. There are various reasons why kinyan might not work there. That's one of the central loci for this question of whether Mechus Ramana applies in cases where kinyan wouldn't be shayach. In the last entry here, in number 11, I quote the Erech Shai, Rav Shlomo Yehuda Tabak, who says that he's going back to that Maramint, who says even without a kinyan, you have Mechus Ramana, and he can call him a Rasha. He says, he makes a distinction between whether kinyan wouldn't work because of Asmachta or because of Davar Shlo Bala Olam. Davar Shlo Bala Olam, we mentioned, is when you don't own the property yet or other such circumstances. Asmachta is when the contract wouldn't work because halacha doesn't allow certain types of conditionals or penalty clauses. Halacha says if a commitment, and the rules are quite complicated, but if the commitment is not 100% certain, involves a penalty, involves something going wrong, involves certain types of conditionals, halacha sometimes says that such contracts are not valid. You don't really mean it. You don't fully appreciate. You don't fully expect to get into that situation. So the Erech Shai distinguishes between these two cases. He says, Davar Shlo Bala Olam, you really mean it, just that there's a technical problem, you don't own it, then there is Mechus Ramana. Asmachta, then there is no Mechus Ramana. Poskim disagree with both these things, I believe. Davar Shlo Bala Olam, some say that that Rameir Arik again has a lengthy discussion about Davar Shlo Bala Olam. He brings Tzadadim possibilities that there is no Mechus Ramana on a Davar Shlo Bala Olam. That again would be relevant to my pancakes. If my wife is promising to make something and she doesn't have the eggs, so her commitment essentially would be to go buy the eggs, and she didn't realize, but the commitment would be to go buy eggs, she doesn't own the eggs. That might be a question of Davar Shlo Bala Olam. And there's a question whether Mechus Ramana applies on a Davar Shlo Bala Olam. Now, it's not so simple, because there are those who argue, and the Davar Shlo Bala Olam is a complicated area of halacha, there are those who argue that as long as we're dealing with a commodity, something which is readily available, not a unique item, not an item which requires negotiation or haggling, we're not talking about a car where I have to assume I can find this model in stock, a dealer will give it to me, etc. There's many a slip twixt cup and lip in those types of situations. You have to get approved, you have to have credit, and this and that. But a simple question like an egg, which there are 20 grocery stores within a few miles that carry eggs, it's not, it's standard, the prices are more or less stable, you can easily find eggs. There are those who argue that's not subject to the rule of Davar Shlo Bala Olam. So there would likely be an idea of Mechus Ramana, even though the eggs weren't in the promisor's possession yet. Just one quick note, just one final thing. We don't really have time to get into this, but one last application of the wording of Mechus Ramana of Hin Tzedek in modern basin context. I don't know where this started. In modern basin context, a person, instead of making an actual shvua, an actual judicial oath when he's supposed to, will often in basin use the expression hin tzedek. I hereby affirm under the label of hin tzedek that my claim is true. So what is that exactly? We use it in place of a shvua. In court, we sometimes say I affirm instead of swear. The court will let you say I affirm, or if I have religious scruples against swearing, I can affirm. So how do we look at these things? Are they quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, so it is a duck or it's not a duck? So with regard to Hin Tzedek, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Avadia, and other poskim have said it is not a shvua. They argue, since the whole point of doing Hin Tzedek and not using the venerable language of shvua is because you don't want to make a shvua, you're explicitly saying you don't want it to be a shvua. So even though you want the next best thing to a shvua, but you don't want a shvua. So we declare things as Hin Tzedek, we're saying we don't want a shvua. Similar argument, I suppose, would apply to affirm. If you're telling the judge, I don't want to take an oath, I want to only affirm, you're saying you don't want it to have the halachic status of a shvua. This is a tricky topic. I didn't do extensive research on this, so probably further analysis is still called for.